All right, here we go. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast number 136, Breathing Patterns Normalized. This week we have three guests. We have Mike McKinney back for round three. He's from Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. He was actually telling me earlier he's got a course on the stuff that we're talking about today going on this weekend at the Boston something group in Boston. I don't know.
BSMPG.
There you go. Whatever. BSMPG. Yeah. All right. So we got that going on about PRI and some new courses there. So we have Josh Ogden. So if you're watching live, he just joined us back again. His camera went off for a second there. He is the assistant director of athletic training at Baylor University. He said this weekend they have their closing series with Texas. So he's been at Baylor for a couple years where he got his master's of athletic training. And he began his PRI courses last year, so he's going to be working on, I think you said you got some this summer, Josh?
The impingement and instability course this summer, yeah.
All right. And then a newcomer to the show is Jason Roby, coming from University of Miami. Jason is the men's basketball athletic trainer by his Twitter handle, CanesMBKAT. So he is a men's basketball athletic trainer there at the University of Miami. He's also written a good bit of work and published it. I've got links to all that in the show notes. But he's a article reviewer for the Journal of Athletic Training, Journal of Sports Rehabilitation. He's also prevention and rehabilitation exercises for the baseball player. So maybe Josh can have some good conversation there because Josh is working primarily with baseball. And then quite a few other things. He's a doctoral candidate from Rocky Mountain University. So we got plenty of qualified presenters here. And so without that there, there we go. All right. So I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right beside me is
Jose.
Shakira.
Matthew.
And Matthew. They were messing with the camera just a second ago, so it was throwing me off. I wasn't sure what was going on. If you want to join our conversation, I know Matt and Doc are logged in there. Do we got anybody? Rob has logged in there. Anybody else, Bob? No. All right. So they're logged in there so that we can join the conversation live there using hashtag DSMB on Twitter. Bob can see that. And any of the links to that stuff is also on our website, again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. But let's get right to it because Mike's going to have to leave a little bit early. Matthew?
Can you please tell us about yourself briefly?
Who? You got to start with somebody. Let's start with you, Mike. You're in the top left.
All right. So just to review what he already said, I'm Mike McKinney. I work at a Northeastern University. Previously, I came from North Dakota State University, where I was doing research in fluid and electrolyte replacement, but also working with college baseball there as well. And then coming here to Northeastern, my experience getting into postural restoration started last year with taking myokinematic restoration and respiration, and this year I'll be continuing on with pelvis and impingement instability and additional talks from PRI practitioners like this week at the BSMPG conference here in Boston.
Okay, and Jason, you?
I'm Jason Roby. I'm currently the associate athletic trainer here at the University of Miami, where I actually started this position about 8 months ago at the beginning of the basketball season. I spent the 8 previous years as the director of sports medicine at Appalachian State University in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina. As far as my postural restoration experience goes, I began taking courses in 2005. I was actually introduced to it in 2003 by my strength and conditioning coach. I was actually a patient myself. I had terrible right SI joint dysfunction. And the traditional treatment might last me 10, 15 minutes. And I went back into pain. Strength coach said to me, hey, why don't you check this out? Let me take a look at you, do these exercises. I did them once and they lasted all day. So I started doing them first thing in the morning. I was good to go all day. And I said, I kind of like this. So that's when I started asking questions and taking courses. So I've been doing postural restoration for the past 10 years now.
All right, and then Josh.
Awesome. I'm originally from Northeast Texas. Did my undergrad at TCU and followed it up with a master's degree from here at Baylor. Worked the baseball team then and have some experience at D3 level at University of Mary Hardin Baylor. So I've covered quite a few sports through that. I got into the PRI courses this past summer in dealing with some athletes that hadn't responded to the more non-traditional treatments. So far, I've done the The malakinematic restoration, the pelvis restoration, postural respiration, and the PRI for baseball course. And I'm, like we mentioned earlier, I'm following that up with the impingement and stability course this following summer. So I've done those courses, done a lot of reading on my own. And I think I'm a bit of a research nerd. So really enjoy this type of topic and conversation.
Yeah, it's actually, I was doing reading the stuff that Jason sent us over Twitter, and I have links to those in the show notes there, the articles. But I'm really glad that, Jason, that you've been through this yourself, like you experienced it first, because I was reading one of the articles and I was like, you know, it just seems honestly too good to be true, like that where the director of the PRI Institute, Harushka, or however you say his name, you know, that he had a guy laying on the table that couldn't lift his shoulder above his head. So then he has him take a breath and is doing something with the, you know, front and back of his chest. And then now he can put his arm up. It really just seems like that's another gimmick. But you've been through it personally, not just done it on people and tricked them into believing it, but you've been through it personally. So, it you know, it's good to hear that.
Yeah. And I can speak on that a little bit as well. I'm a patient a bit myself, I guess. The student athlete I was referencing, he had a hip issue and had been referred out to a PT that used some PRI techniques on him. And when I saw how well he was doing, how fast he was progressing, I kind of thought, well, I'll try the same exercise. And this is going off of a sheet of paper that I was literally handing him a sheet and say, do these exercises just like he wrote them down. And I have pretty significant osteoarthritis in my left knee, and I noticed an immediate benefit that when I do the rehab exercises that I need to be doing, I feel good for 2 or 3 days.
So even with a condition like osteoarthritis?
I will say it's personally made a difference for me, yes.
Well, Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, I think where people might not say like, oh, osteoarthritis, I think what Josh is getting at is maybe the repositioning exercises allow him to disperse forces differently through the joint from the pelvis and the diaphragm and the orientation of the thorax. And even depending on the exercises, position of the head, position of your vision, where you're looking down the road. And then that doesn't mean arthritis goes away. It's just we're making movement more efficient for Josh to basically be pain-free. And I'm someone with a history of back surgery myself, so I can tell you right now that I didn't have PRI until recently. And some of the lingering things I've been dealing with for probably up to 10 years at this point are now, frankly, gone away. I had a practitioner treat me at a course last year, and I haven't had a problem since. And that was just 2 days.
Nice. So. All right, Jose has a question.
Mike, can you please define normalize, since no two people move the same?
I would agree. No two people do move the same. So what we talk about when we speak with normalized breathing pattern is, also you can look at it as efficient breathing, kind of like we've talked in previous podcasts about breathing, is this basic compensation of a hyperinflated left chest wall. And so what that does is it takes the mechanical advantage away from the diaphragm. So then that breathing is disjointed, and where we tend to use accessory muscles to complete breathing, and it drives us into extension. And so when we say we want to normalize that, is we want to try and get the diaphragm to regain that mechanical advantage, its domed position at rest. And so we can use that now as our new foundation to work on performance, work on pain reduction. There's a huge, huge opportunity of things to work on once you get to that point.
All right, Jason, Josh, you got anything to add to that?
I would say, you know, much like Mike said, it's not necessarily normalizing breathing, but efficiency of breathing. Depending on which study you read, the average respiration rate for an adult can be anywhere from, the average is 12 to 16, but can be 8 to 20, depending on which source you look at. And no two people, just with their individual history, their ribs, their thorax, their diaphragm, their scalenes, they can't necessarily move exactly the same. So I would say that normal is something that's relevant to each individual. But what we talk about in this case is being able to use the diaphragm as a respiratory muscle, to use it efficiently to bring air in, and then to exhale primarily with the muscles of exhalation and not in a kind of a passive state where you remain hyperinflated and get into, I'm sure we'll talk in a minute about accessory breathing patterns with the scalenes and the SCMs, but things that elevate the rib cage and lead to extension tone, pain, you name it.
Right. That's, you know, the biggest thing is to return somebody, again, like you said, to normalize breathing, which would be more of using the diaphragm and getting away from the accessory respiratory muscles, allowing the body to relax. And it allows you to help regulate your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, which, again, if you're not using your diaphragm, you're using your accessory muscles. You go into extension, that increases your sympathetic nervous system, which is flight or fight, while sympathetic being flight. And then what that does is just throws in a cascade of everything else that can go on. And you're looking to kind of turn yourself back to almost a homeostatic state where you can breathe quietly, where your diaphragm functions properly. And again, you're not using the accessory muscles.
All right. So when I was reading the article you sent, Jason, it was talking about your ribs flare out. So obviously I'm sitting there trying to figure out, like trying to breathe without my ribs flaring out. So talk to me about, cause it talked about the point of apposition or something like that. I think it was a POA or APO, something. What is it?
It's the zone of apposition.
Zone of apposition. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about that. And, I guess in a very elementary way, explain or the rib flaring, and like if I'm sitting here trying to breathe so that my ribs aren't flaring, how am I going to do that?
Okay. Well, what's going on when they're talking about rib flaring, you're actually breathing with your chest. If we kind of take a look at this as our rib cage, all right, when we rib flare, we get into that extended position like we're talking about. You're using your accessory respiratory muscles. Okay, your SCM, your anterior scalenes, your pec minor, pec major, raising your chest up and externally rotating your rib cage, which, as you can see, what Mike is doing is also anteriorly tilting the pelvis. Because what that does is it takes your diaphragm from that domed, kind of like a upside down J. When your ribs come up, it flattens it out, kind of makes it like an upside down L. So you're looking at an external rotation of the rib. Well, what helps keep that rib cage down or bringing it in, which would be our exhalation. So you're looking at, you need to engage your internal and external obliques. Make sure that the psoas is off, not counterbalancing it. And then you have a little muscle that sits actually up underneath the sternum, known as the transverse thoracis or triangularis sterni muscle, which also pulls your rib cage down. Okay. That is faulty breathing. You may get that either on the left may flare up or both sides may flare up. True diaphragmatic breathing, when we talk about chest expansion, it's more of expanding in a three-dimensional state. Okay. It doesn't externally rotate, come up like you do into extension or like your arms go into external rotation. It actually goes into a full expansion as the diaphragm pulls down, allowing the lungs to expand and have full access. So in order to breathe properly, one, we get you in a position to shut down the psoas and get you out of this state and work on our exhalation of actually engaging the obliques to bring your rib cage down and to keep it down.
All right. I love the visual cues that Mike has given us with the pelvis there. So I'm sitting here listening to what you're saying. And if my shoulders are going back when I'm breathing, then that's incorrect.
Right.
Yes.
I kind of feel like my chest is going outward to the left and right and the front and back, not up and down. Right.
I would add breathe in through your nose, but try and focus your breath into your belly button. Try and draw the air down as you breathe in. And that's everybody try that.
Are y'all trying that?
if you take a deep breath in with your nose, focus that down into your belly button, you should feel, you know, not just the stretch into your abdomen, but the stretch across your rib cage as well, where you're actually operating in three dimensions now instead of internal external rotation.
Yeah, it's definitely different, but breathing through my nose is not normal, I guess. I don't know. I don't think I'm a mouth breather, but maybe.
Yeah, and it's more about like when you breathe, like you breathe in through your nose and you exhale out your mouth. Because if you breathe in through your mouth, you get all these accessory muscles helping pull that rib cage up and contributing to these patterns. So if you breathe through your nose and exhale out your mouth, you're not going to notice your rib cage flare as much just simply by changing that process.
All right, so just by practicing breathing through my nose, will it'll become more normal throughout my day? Like, say, a 5 or 10 minute intentional nose breathing practice?
That's the goal.
Typically, yes.
Okay. All right, so then one of the other things I had questions about, and, you know, we commented briefly on Twitter, is the other article was talking about left and right nasal passageway breathing, right? So you're just clogging one nasal passageway and breathing in through the other. And what is the point of that? Let's start with Jason, since you sent me the article. Will you go ahead?
Okay, what we're looking at there is more of what you would catch in the TMCC. I think they call it the cervical rotation course now. That if you look at somebody's facial features and you look at them from shoulder up now, you may look at somebody as they're sitting there, one side of the face is going to be flat. It's going to be slightly rotated back, tilted. The other side's going to be bigger. You'll have a shift of the mouth. You'll also have one nostril actually functioning better than the other nostril. And what this is actually doing is kind of reversing that pattern. Just like you talk about a left AIC pattern at the pelvis, a right brachial chain pattern up to the shoulder, we also get what we call this right TMCC pattern that goes up into the head and working with the skull. So by limiting that right side and forcing air in through the left is allowing to get air up into this left side and actually expand this side of your face. And that allows for proper functioning of the temporal bones, which also internally and externally rotate, and positioning of the sphenoid. And we know that the sphenoid bone regulates probably 80-85% of our body function and what's going on.
Yeah. Aside, along with that, and kind of prepping to do this podcast, I guess, I've done a lot of research reading, and you come across articles on yoga breathing or pranayama breathing. Those settings, yoga practitioners have alternated nostril breathing for, in some cases, thousands of years. With the theory being that we obviously have hemispheric dominance in terms of which half of the brain controls what. And there's in their theory, the airflow from one nostril may affect either through heating or cooling hemispheric dominance, so that at certain times we may be more more language dominant or more physically dominant. So, along with the PRI aspect or the osteopathic aspect, there's other schools of thought that have been around for thousands of years on that. And in the article that Jason, you sent us, they talk about the heart risk factors, that one, correct? Or cardiovascular risk factors where,
right.
Breathing out of, right side only, increased heart rate, systolic blood pressure, decreased heart rate variability, and the left nostril did the opposite. That feeds perfectly well into the osteopathic model of a nasal cycle where we shift nasal dominance every 1.5 to 2 hours. And it's just an alternating cycle where we increase state and we decrease state.
And that, like I said, that goes along with, so breathing in through that right nostril, being able to get air into that upper chest wall, that's where you're, again, driving in that extension, you're becoming hyperventilated, and that's where all those pathological conditions come from. And again, as we speak, we want to focus on, they're talking about you breathe better through the left side of the nose, which a lot of people need to dominantly be able to do, is to be able to get there. But the other thing that we need to focus on is the ability to, again, reciprocate, to be able to breathe through both nostrils, like Josh was saying. And just like, being able to move through both sides of your body, PRI stance is kind of like you're positioned, over to the right too much. We need to get you to the left, but that doesn't mean to keep you in that left stance. It's to be able to get you to get over into that left and then get back to the right and to reciprocate. And our rib cage also needs to be able to reciprocate with our breathing as well, because it also should be reciprocally moving with our gait pattern. And yes, we should also reciprocate up at the nostrils as well.
All right. So as I'm sitting here trying to kind of do what you guys are talking about, like I feel like I can't, like if I breathe in through my nose, then I can't breathe, then I don't breathe out through my mouth. So then I'm just breathing in and out through my nose, which that's not what you said to do. But then also I feel like I have this, what I could think of as the opposite of exercise-induced asthma, just because I'm thinking about my breathing. Now it's like harder for me to breathe normally. Is that normal? Mike, why don't we start with you?
Yes. You'll also find that sometimes when we actually take people through this, like we're correcting their position, it's something new, it's foreign to them. We're trying to turn that sympathetic tone off, but sometimes we can actually create it by like, okay, having someone blow through a straw, that's unnatural right away. So it does take training. This isn't something you just do once and forget about it. And so the fact that you're thinking about it, and you're already noticing by changing your body position, you're getting rid of those compensations, and now it's actually more difficult to breathe, actually takes us down that treatment logarithm with PRI of where do we need to go next. So when I have you in a good position, how do we breathe better there? Because a lot of times, and this is what we see with athletes, is they get in this really hyperextended pattern. Pitchers in baseball, you see this. The hockey players I work with are all like this. They've got to perform in a position, so they learn to compensate and breathe in that position. But kind of what Jason was talking about, turning that switch off, like in the last podcast, we talked about kind of like what Eric Otter talked about, not letting the lion follow me home, you know, leaving the lion at the ice rink, at the baseball diamond, whatever. And so that's how, you know, you got to work at it. It's not just a one day thing.
All right. So from there, we've kind of covered basically what the PRI, what the normalizing breathing is. But Mike, when we start with you, when do you use this? When do you not use this? I know you said you want them, in the last time we talked, you want them to stay, you want them, whenever they're performing, you don't want to mess up their performance. So when they're like in season or whenever they're on the field, you don't do it. But whenever they're off the field, like you just said, leave the lion at the zoo or something, which is
the lion follows you home from the zoo. I'm sure that's a problem. So, so when we do this, I usually incorporate it in all my treatments. Especially, I mean, obviously I work a very high injury rate contact sport. So if someone gets blown up at center ice, I have a pretty good idea of why they're hurt. But the more chronic things that come along, it's like, okay, I need to see why this is happening. Or when we have someone score really low in our movement screening, there's research out there that shows 13 and lower on an FMS score shows breathing dysfunction. Now, not necessarily breathing as in what we're talking about with PRI and our assessment tools, but just breathing pattern disordered in general, using a totally different breathing criteria. So I'll know people that are flagged that I need to look at further for movement screen, and then I'll introduce breathing interventions as well. And then this can shape their training program and my rehab program, me and my strength coach working together. Now, when I don't use it, you kind of already got to that. So say if we're, let's say I'm working with the baseball team and we're going into conference and I've got my number one starter, my ace starting Monday, I'm not going to teach him how to turn tone off Sunday night because I might actually negatively affect his performance or his control, or I'm not going to definitely do it the day of the game. Now, after the game, if I've got a week before he throws again, maybe there's some basic things we can do, but we're not trying to neurologically shift him completely out of his performance comfort zone. That's off-season stuff. That's post-season stuff. Or in the case of hockey and other professional sports after college are a good example. They've got camps that come up in July. We've got to work with that and make sure that we're not sending people off to professional scouting camps that now all of a sudden I hurt their performance and now that can affect them, you know, down the road with their potential professional organization.
Gotcha. Josh, Jason, any other thoughts there on that?
No, I completely agree. And especially during fall ball, you know, I found the same thing. And I would say that I don't necessarily use breathing retraining in all of my rehab scenarios, especially, you know, in case for guys playing through something and we're working to keep them on the field. But there's also the aspect of patient buy-in. And if I can, you know, on a first rehab session, if I can tell just from the way somebody's receiving what I'm telling them, you know, maybe I don't go whole hog with the breathing training right away. Maybe we get to that 2, 3, 4 weeks down the road when we have the relationship between, you know, athletic trainer and patient, and they're starting to feel better and realize, okay, maybe this guy's not nuts, and maybe this will help. I've run into guys like that that, you know, if I hand them a straw on the first day, they're walking out the door.
I agree with both Mike and Josh. One other thing that I do is, you know, when my athletes come in, you get that history and find out who has asthma, or more importantly, you know, in our field would be EIB, the exercise-induced bronchospasms, and take a look at, you know, what's causing that, the underlying factor there. I have, obviously, asthma is more of a allergic reaction, but the bronchospasms is due to hyperventilation. So when I have an athlete who comes in with the EIB, I'll immediately go ahead and put them into a breathing program to get them out of that hyperventilated state.
Yeah. And one of the ways I increase buy-in is if, say, a guy's like giving me a hard time, like, why am I doing this breathing stuff? How's it going to help me? Instead of putting them in all these different positions that are maybe difficult and they don't know how to do yet, I bolster them with towels and foam and all sorts of things and just say, relax in this position. And then they're like, holy cow, I can breathe better. My back pain's gone. And why does my left shoulder feel better? And then I'm like, that's where I'm going to get you. When I take all these bolsters and supports away, we're training you to get there. They start to buy in from there, because a lot of the PRI exercises are not just, okay, here's one exercise, go do it, and it's the only exercise you do. They have progressions from working on sagittal, frontal, and then triplanar movements. So athletes will buy in to how their strength training programs work, which are gradual progressions working up to larger movements, and PRI movements work like that as well.
Right. And I mean, there are times that I start with something as simple as supine breathing, you know, with the hands in a high low position, focus on diaphragmatic breathing first, before I would even, you know, put a bolster under them, before I'd even give them a straw, any progression, just simple, you know, high low breathing with hand placement.
Yeah. All right, Mike, I know you had a kind of a page of notes there, so hit me up with some of the stuff that you had there that you wanted to talk about.
I was just more focusing on, so with like normalized breathing, like how we apply this to like a broader spectrum, data gathering, there's things like that we can talk about. As far as like notes, one of the things that people always ask, like, well, how do you measure this? We're moving into more of that evidence-based realm of, okay, that's great. You know, I can take goniometric measurements, which we should be taking anyway. We can show the effectiveness of some of these treatments, but what else do we do? At least here, I know we do actually some spirometry measurements with a lot of our sports using the Pro2 oxygen, or not oxygen analyzer, just the breathing analyzer, where we can measure max inspiratory pressure and tidal volume. And we've been actually noticing post PRI treatments over, and these are global interventions too, of additional lift, that we've got athletes that are increasing their max inspiratory pressure and, you know, tidal volumes at rest, and we haven't done anything else. And when you associate these with athletes that all of a sudden now their back pain's starting to go away that they've had since they were in junior hockey, you're pitching in baseball or playing AAU basketball, that's something to pay attention to. So I think this is, it gives us that opportunity to fuse it with sports medicine. And in the high school setting, I think it's a very valuable tool, because you've got athletes that are basically the crossover between a pediatric orthopedic, you know, population to an adult population. And a lot of things with the neurodevelopmental model of rehab that works with postural restoration can work very well, I think, in a high school setting. There's a lot of non-manual before manual exercises. So there's a lot of, you know, home exercise program things you can do with athletes and do really good work, especially in settings where you might have one of, I mean, I started out in the high school. I was in that realm too. It was just me and another athletic trainer and 700 athletes. So the ability to give them something to do, I think, is the benefit of normalized breathing. You can make their lives better outside of sports.
It just seems so strange to me. And when I was reading that article that Jason sent, and someone said it, you know, it's often mentioned as voodoo or something like that. It just really seems, you know, from what I've learned, well, we should be doing something else. We should be doing some sort of stretching or strength training. But essentially, that's what you're doing. You're just stretching out the internal muscles rather than, because they've been tight, because we haven't been using them correctly. It's kind of just, you have to change the perspective. So,
yeah. It's about inhibition, something that we're looking at. But Jason, you had something?
Yeah, what we're looking at here is, you know, why it seems like voodoo, why it works so quickly, is basically it's what we're looking at and dealing with is more of neuroscience. We are doing neuromuscular retraining and activity. You know, and what they're coming with, you know, in terms of brain research, is, and that is how the brain can actually change, and the neuroplasticity of how things can function at the brain. And that's all we're doing. You know, we're looking at communicating with the brain, allowing the brain to get a chance to kind of reset itself. So, you know, we're focusing on more of a neurological, neuromuscular effect. And it's the brain that's making these changes. We're really not doing anything. You know, we're just kind of talking to the brain, and the brain can make changes extremely quickly. And a lot of that can also be driven through the eyes, which, you know, could be a different presentation. But, you know, this is more of a neuroscience, a neurological, and it's not so much that straight orthopedic stuff that we're taught. When you actually get down to the neuroscience of the body, that's where everything is driven and managed by. And that's where our changes are coming from. And that's why we're so successful, is we're talking to the brain, communicating with it, and allowing the brain to make the appropriate changes instead of trying to fight with things structure-wise or orthopedically.
Right. And I would add, you know, yes, on we're talking on a neurological level. In simplest terms, if you want to relate this back to an orthopedic term, or what we're traditionally taught in our sports medicine, in our medical education, you know, you're always taught you have to inhibit, correct, and then facilitate. That's really all we're doing. We're just, instead of using a foam roller, to inhibit, you know, use a Thomas Myers term, you know, a superficial front line. Instead of using a foam roller to inhibit our quads and our adductors, you know, we're using a diaphragm to inhibit the psoas from the top. We're still working along the same chains of muscles. It's just using a different technique to address it. One that works on a deeper neurological level. And, you know, ideally, if you facilitate correctly afterwards, in my experience, leads to more rapid and longer term change.
Exactly.
All right. So when am I not going to use this? Cause it, you know, from reading the research, it shows, oh yeah, it's going to fix everything. Like I said, it's, you know, quote unquote voodoo. So if I understand we're going to not do it right before, or, you know, the day of the game, right before a big performance, so that we're changing stuff. But how do I know when the breathing is not the issue? Let's start with you, Mike.
So obviously, like I was kind of talking about that acute injury situation, I saw it happen in front of me. I know why this happened, especially in a contact sport. Physics take over, a big guy hit a slightly not as big guy, and well, bad things happen sometimes. But I think there's also some post-operative implications, where if you're dealing with somebody who may have a surgery on a limb that they're not using really well, you can actually, we had a pretty good talk about this on some message boards with PRI, that we shift somebody over onto maybe an extremity more than they're used to and don't continue to train them in that setting because we can't, because of maybe a post-operative something or something like that, and actually increase the potential for injury. And that's where you have to use that clinical decision-making is this right for them right now? Or the other thing, quite frankly, rib fractures. We're dealing with breathing. So if we have rib fracture, a rib joint issue, a sternal issue, a thoracic spine issue, that's we're trying to mobilize these joints in a healthy manner. And if the joint isn't healthy, you have to be very careful how you progress with those types of treatments.
Any other thoughts, Jason, Josh?
Along the same lines, you got to keep in mind that, like Mike was talking about, in a collision sport, hockey, football, even a collision at the plate, you know, in my experience with baseball, an acute injury obviously is not because of a breathing pattern, but these things also feed forward, feed back. You know, an orthopedic injury can cause a breathing problem later, just as much as a breathing issue can cause pain in an orthopedic sense.
Yeah, Jason,
go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, to be honest with you, I mean, it's a hard question to answer outside of acute situations, because I find very few situations where it's not beneficial, because I can modify everything to fit body position. But again, like rib fractures, that's the big one. I mean, I'm working with their ribs, mobilizing ribs. Well, if we have a fracture, we got an issue. So,
all right. So all three of you guys are pretty into research. Josh just admitted it. Jason, you've obviously written papers and you read articles as part of your job there. And Mike, we've talked about that before. You kind of like all the research. What is the data that you guys are collecting and finding off of this? And then what are some of the things going forward from there? Start again with Mike.
So some of the data we gather, it's just, we just look at movement data. The problem is with any data collection, you have to isolate variables. And so when we look at our movement data that we gather with all of our athletes who go through breathing interventions, there's also a number of other things they've done as well. So I'd like to say, because of my PRI intervention, my corrective work with the pelvis there, say FMS or their score improved, or they went to functional with their SFMA evaluation. But unfortunately, I can't say that completely because they're doing also some traditional strength training with this for gains and things like that. What we've been doing with the Pro 2 and the data we're gathering with that, again, is in its infancy, but it's just things that we're noticing in those, you know, those potentials down the road. The difficulty with that is there's such a high variability from person to person with the neurological system that you're going to have variability just in the results at the end of the day. So I think the data is going to more focus on outcomes than with supporting these treatments, more than like getting down to the nitty gritty, what neurological pathway is firing and that sort of thing.
Right. Now, I would agree completely. In my sense, you know, I focus on the outcomes or on the outcome data. While you were saying that, I just recalled that one of our grad assistants, young lady, Megan Fault, is finishing up a master's thesis where she compared the Throwers 10 program to the PRI program. A little bit of myokinematic, a little bit of right BC program, in terms of range of motion increase. But the thing that she found was there's so many outside uncontrollable factors that maybe one day you do a baseline measurement on these athletes at 4 p.m., but, you know, their follow-up occurs at 7 a.m. because they have weights right after, that they're tighter time of day, whether it's because they just woke up neurologically. Maybe something changed in their injury history. Maybe something changed in their training history. The biggest thing she ran into was the outside variables and the lack of control that she had there.
Jason?
Yeah. Again, you look at the outcomes, but, the biggest thing in terms of writing research and trying to do any type of randomized controlled trial is the fact that each patient needs separate attention. I'm going to treat each patient differently. And when you're doing a research trial or, that young lady's master's thesis, outside those variables there's also underlying postural variables that she might not be picking up. I actually worked with Dr. Boyle. We did a RCT on traditional treatment of sacroiliac joint dysfunction compared to postural restoration. And we had gotten great results. And, we're waiting for that to be accepted by the spine journal. But one of the patients that we had was a student of mine. She just didn't get better with the postural restoration results. And after talking to her and evaluating her further, I determined that, she needed some dental orthotics. The fact that her SI joint wasn't getting better was actually due to bruxism at night and hyperactivity of her jaw muscles and her bite. So it's tough for, any type of research project when you're looking at the therapeutic intervention again, because each person needs to be able to have a specific plan for that person. Establishing the Throwers 10 or even establishing the exercise book that I did, the way that I wrote that baseball book allows you to more freely move from the different exercises and to interchange them, and gives you a broad spectrum of exercises to do so you can meet different needs of everybody instead of trying to do the exact same intervention. So when you're looking at, publishing RCTs, your results are going to be tough. Like Josh said, you have, when working with the athletes, a lot of external forces and issues that you go against. And that's one reason why, I published the case studies. It's not quite that higher level of evidence, but it is evidence. You're looking at level 3 evidence, and after you get so many case studies, case series, then you can put together a meta-analysis and increase that. But trying to throw everybody into the same group, kind of like a cookie cutter treatment, it's almost impossible to see those great results.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Mike, I know you're going to have to leave in just a little bit here. So why don't you take us a little bit deeper into normalizing breathing? Because honestly, other than what you guys have told me, I don't really know what it is. So just take us a little deeper.
So the first thing we do, I guess it kind of helps to probably go through the evaluative process of how we normalize breathing. There's a point where you can look at people. I think Jason and Josh can both say this, that you can bet with pretty good accuracy, like that guy's probably got, you know, something going on with, again, these natural compensations that we have. So when we get people on the table and we do some evaluative tools, one of them is we call the adduction drop test, which is actually a modified Oberst. So if you can imagine that, that's kind of the position we're starting in. That's a test that obviously people do for the IT band, but if you follow the pathways of the tissue that contribute to the IT band and that whole just side of the body, you're also testing back and pelvis position, where that SI joint is with my pelvis. Okay. So if the pelvis is up, my acetabulum is not going to be aligned. And so when I bring that leg down to finish Oberst, it's not going to go anywhere because the bones are frankly running into each other. And then the tissue is aligned in such a way that it's not going to let that happen. Where this comes into normalizing breathing is the position of the diaphragm and its influence in the lumbar spine and pelvis. So then we take people through a series of exercises to gain what we referred to in the beginning as that zone of apposition, that starting point that allows us to basically explore the world from a breathing standpoint, but they got to get there first. If they don't have there, it makes your life a lot more difficult. And so once we go through this process of going through some basic breathing exercises, we retest. So it kind of gets after that. Again, these themes in athletic training that apply to postural restoration is we need to be testing and retesting. Are our treatments working? Not just do they feel better is important, but can I actually see improvement? I see that adduction drop test, I get motion out of it, or I change an endpoint, or I get a lot more motion, I know I'm in a better position where I can normalize their breathing. And then when I have them supine on their back, like you were talking about earlier, that rib flare out, ideally when we go through normalizing their breathing patterns with exercises or manual techniques, we like to see that rib flare come down a little bit and move equally on the right and left side as they fill with air. And then going on from there, that's just on the table. And this is where we talk about normalizing, you know, it's kind of a bad pun, but it's infancy. They're on their table, they're on their back like a baby or a 3-month-old baby or something like that. And then we stand them up and start working with exercises in that regard. And then hopefully we teach them to, I know I tweeted out about this and some people ask questions about teaching them to live in a better position throughout the day. Simply doing that will treat themselves. So if we normalize that breathing pattern with our clinical expertise and we get them to treat themselves by living in a better position, that's what we're getting at for normalizing breathing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So other thoughts there, Josh, Jason?
I don't really have a whole lot to add on that. I said a lot of times for me, it is just as basic as breathe in through the nose, exhale through the mouth, maybe add resistance, make it take a little bit longer. Actually get them to focus on the breathing increases relaxation and lets me be more effective with any other techniques I may use.
And then you can also take concepts of PRI, this concept of threat, and not even do it with, you can normalize breathing and not even touch the patient. I think we had a discussion about delivering bad news on the left side of the table instead of the right side of the table, and all of a sudden you've got a different human on your table. Or color. I know I've had athletes, some throwers working on shot put and movements, but I changed the color of the ball they were holding because in their peripheral vision, it wasn't the same color as what they throw in competition. Once we changed that color, hip pain went away because now they're not focused on why do I have this neon colored thing that I don't ever compete with. So there's concepts beyond me pushing on somebody's rib cage, I think is what they were describing in that article with Ron Ruska. And then Jason and Josh can probably talk about the baseball integration with where they taped the color of the baseball. And they had people, were they hooked up to an EMG? Do I remember right hearing this? They were able to basically change somebody's response simply by the color of the baseball. There's so much you can do just by simple actions and that we take that we're not even touching people and we can make an impact on their day. So it's more about, again, that's that neurological component rather first and then biomechanics second.
Right. The thing I recall in the baseball, I don't don't think it was an EMG if they measured the internal and external goniometer. And when they taped the seams, wrapped the ball in PowerFlex, whatever, the internal rotation increased because when you take a baseball player and you put their socks on them, put their glove on them, their cap, and put a ball in their hand, they're wired up, they're ready to go, they're ready to go throw that ball. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back with that to fight or flight versus relaxation that we've always been talking about here. And just the perception of the seams, you know, can affect the overall tone of the body.
Jason, anything?
No, huh? I agree with that.
All right, so what else, Mike, before you have to bolt?
Before I have to go? I don't know. I think it's really, this supports, and they can probably talk about this after I leave, and we kind of already got there with the research discussion, is this struggle between internal and external validity, but you'll find it more in athletic training with the struggle between patient-centered values and disease-oriented treatments. So it's at the end of the day, it's like we want to see, okay, internal rotation improve and maybe the hip, and then all of a sudden their groin pain goes away. But now, what does that matter to the patient? And that's that patient buy-in. And so what PRI, I think, does really well is it gets that patient buy-in because it is patient-centered. How do you feel? There is no wrong answer. When I have someone get off my table, they can tell me it didn't work. That's cool. It gives me information to adjust my the treatment paradigm I've put them in. Or they can say, holy cow, I haven't felt like this since ever. I mean, when we have athletes come in that said, I have this pain underneath my scapula, which is a rib that's not moving as well as it should. We take them through some simple breathing exercises and it goes away. And all of a sudden this kid's cervical rotation improves. And he looks at me like I just did witchcraft. It's like, no, I didn't. I just taught you to use your body better. I haven't seen him since. Like sometimes that happens, you know, I follow up with him. He says, I feel great. I'm doing my sport great. I have no pain. And that's important too. You're returning people to their sport, is in our job, that's important. That's why we're here. But to the athlete, that's important. Sometimes we get lost in the, well, how's your internal rotation? I'm not sure. We might need to limit some things today. That'll ruin them. But if you get them back on the field, even if they're, you know, with some limitations, with PRI, they're going to buy into what you're doing because, okay, I'm back on the field. This is working for me. It's keeping me, in a collegiate setting. This is the opportunity that got me here. I want to keep doing it. This is my next step to the professional level. Or, you know, same thing to even those that work in general population settings. This might just be getting somebody back to work so they can make a living. And so we focus on the performance aspect really heavily, but you see a lot of really huge benefits of PRI just in the general population. Things that if I could have gone back in time, of course I can't, but if I could, what this could have done for my patients that were, say, general population patients, kind of get mad at myself sometimes because I really want to, or when I worked baseball, I didn't know some of this stuff and I really want to go back and say, man, I could do better. And then I think this just gets at, you know, make yourselves better, go beyond an entry level education.
Yeah. It's amazing with the podcast, you know, the more I do it, the more I open up to other things that I see. And it's kind of the same thing. It's, you know, I think we talked last time how I want to do the FMS. And then after we do the FMS, maybe I can do the PRI stuff so I can have a base to test them and then, you know, do this to treat them. And it's just, there's a lot of stuff I'd like to do. It just seems like you can easily get lost in all the possibilities.
Oh yeah, I think they said it's like a high dive or a rabbit hole, and I like to say it's the high dive, and I jumped off in the deep end head first, so my breathing pattern's not good for that, so it's the way it goes.
All right.
So yeah, so I've got to get running, so I'll leave the rest to Jason and Josh, I'm sure, you know, especially with Jason's a wealth of knowledge on this topic, more so than myself by many, many miles. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks. Enjoy the rest, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Right. Thanks for joining us.
Guys.
See ya.
Nice to meet you, Jason. Yep.
All right. So there we go. Now it's your time to shine there, Josh, Jason, so you can take it away. I know Matt Babasek is listening, and he said he's kind of scooped up all the free information he can about PRI. There we go. My Skype was frozen for a second. You guys were stuck grinning. He said he scooped up all the free information he can about PRI. What else can you tell him about the process, or maybe you can tell him about how to do some of the evaluations without crossing any lines or getting into trouble or anything like that. Why don't we start with you, Jason?
That's kind of tough. Just reading what you get online and stuff, isn't telling you how to treat a patient or anything. without taking a course. One thing that I tell everybody where you can get a lot from one exercise if you haven't taken a course is the 90-90 balloon blow, whether you use a right arm reach with it or you use the right arm reach without the balloon blow. But if you can add that in there, that one exercise, if you read the article by Dr. Kendall Boyle on the value of blowing up a balloon, if you want to start treating people without having any information, that's the best place to go. Just learn how to do that exercise, learn it well, and you can actually do a lot from there. As far as treating everybody else without taking the courses, you know, you really can't do that because, again, each person's different, and you can't do cookie-cutter treatment.
Yeah, that exercise, I actually had one of our strength conditioning interns do Sunday, and before a 90% squat workout, went back in on Monday, and boy, how'd it feel? Man, it was really, really stinking light. I could have done at least 105% for triples. So it made a huge difference to him.
Yeah, the exercise is taught at the beginning, but yet as you go in through the courses, you realize that one exercise is very integrative through all sorts of things. And I use it and give it to probably almost every patient as a beginning exercise. I may alter things based off the patient, but to me, that's my go-to exercise. It does so much. So if you introduce that, and if that's the only thing that you do, you actually can see a lot of benefits from it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I would add, if you scoop up all the free information, keep looking. There's more free information that comes out all the time. And I have done the courses, and I keep looking. I know I haven't done the worksheet for this podcast yet. On the last one, I listed multiple blogs that, give information on courses, course recaps, not just on PRI, but, they cover a lot. You can always find more. If you really have scooped up all the free information, the home study courses are a really good way to go. I did that for three of those courses. It may not be the ideal, but in some cases, in all cases, really, we have limited budget. We're athletic trainers. That's another topic for another day. But, we can't always afford to fly. Like, I'm going to Boston for a two-day course this summer, and between the travel and the course, I've used up my budget for the entire year. So if you are, on a limited budget, they're, in my mind, relatively affordable. You compare that to some of the four-day, I know Eric Cressy does a four-day baseball strength conditioning internship, as he calls it, and it's like 850, something like that for a four-day course. The PRI courses are 400 and change, which is, basically the going rate for anything like that. The FRC, the functional range conditioning, or functional anatomic palpation, those are two-day courses that in some cases get up to $800. So you can find things that are more expensive.
And there's also other information that's out there. Postural restoration just didn't pop out of, out of nowhere. Ron has done a lot of research in different areas in terms of, breathing. We look at dental stuff. We look at vision stuff. You can look at craniosacral therapy. All sorts of things actually can build onto your knowledge of the PRI. But like Josh said, if you look at the value, home study course is great. The very first course, the myokinematic restoration course, has actually been recently approved for the BOC's evidence-based credits that we're required to get. So if you're looking at getting those right now, they're pretty hard to come by. Here at the university, we hosted a five-hour course, and we had a ton of people here because everybody's trying to scramble around to get those EBP courses for the BOC. Well, the very first course, in person or home study, you get those hours as well.
Regrettably, it's not retroactive to when I did it, though.
Not retroactive.
I did get on Twitter and ask Ron about that one. along with what you're saying, with the foundations of it. I mean, since getting into that, it's led me to read textbooks on craniosacral breathing rehabilitation. Gone back and reread Greenman's manual medicine textbook from grad school that I kind of blew over then. You know, and there's, you can take a lot of muscle energy techniques, a lot of, you know, osteopathic techniques to, and, you know, just because it came out of a different book doesn't mean it doesn't fit the same system or the same outcome goal, which is patient improvement. Return to sport, return to work, whatever setting you're in. So like I said, it's led me to read a lot more than I ever thought I would.
Definitely myself as well. Definitely.
All right, keep going. What else you got? So I know they had mentioned overhead sports, you know, basketball. You're doing a lot of overhead baseball. You're doing a lot of overhead. So why don't you take it away there? Start us off, Josh, and you can fill in, Jason.
The thing I find most commonly, you know, if we're putting in a PRI term, the right-handed guys fit the lefty IC, right BC pattern. Almost without fail, there's going to be some form of I don't want to say respiratory dysfunction, but, secondary respiratory muscle overuse. They're going to have tight scalenes, tight SCMs, primarily on the throwing side, primarily if they're right-handed hitters. One of the big issues that has started to be addressed in professional and college baseball is thoracic outlet syndrome. You know, when I was in college, and it hadn't been that long ago, it's like you talk about it, there's arterial venous neurologic, but you almost never see it, you know, maybe once in your career. Well, not really. Started to see a lot of thoracic outlet syndrome type issues. The classic, you know, oh, he's just got a dead arm. He's got to throw through it. Nowadays, we're saying, well, that's thoracic outlet. We need to release the pecs, release the scalenes. Well, you know, what causes that? Well, respiratory dysfunction. They're using their accessory muscles. And if they're constantly...
Good article on that.
Yeah, you did have a good article on that. So Jason can throw a whole lot more in here. But if they're constantly, like we were talking about early, you know, not using their diaphragm to breathe, or, you know, with a high low type test and they can't move their abdominal hand first, if they're constantly going through that, then those muscles they're being trained to stay tight. They're being trained to elevate the first rib to increase the thoracic outlet compression. Part of detraining those muscles, inhibiting those muscles, has got to be increasing diaphragmatic function and internal oblique transverse abdominis use for the exhale. If you don't address that, I'm sorry, I can sit here and stretch your pecs, I can stretch your scalenes, I can, you know, work on the more traditional middle and lower traps, serratus type exercises for posture, whatever. If you stay in that hyperinflated state, and what we mean by hyperinflated are hypocapnia, basically they have too much oxygen, they can't exhale. It alters the CO2 levels in the body, which alters, you know, fight or flight. We can take this down a whole other rabbit hole. Keep it mechanical, mechanistic. But if I can't shut these muscles off because I can't breathe without them, it doesn't matter how much stretching I do as an athletic trainer, a physical therapist, whatever, we're never going to get those muscles to relax. As soon as they stand back up, they're going to want to use those because that's the only way they know how to breathe. So for me, for thoracic outlet, breathing retraining is a huge part of that. It's not always successful. I've had athletes that have undergone a first rib resection, but I've also had quite a few that we've been able to keep out of the OR with some of these breathing techniques. And I just rambled a lot. So Jason, if you'd like to pick up on that.
No, I definitely agree. You know, like Josh was saying, again, it goes to a neurological response. We can stretch and stretch and stretch as much as what we want, but if you have the dysfunctional breathing, the brain's going to drive it back to what it knows best, and it's going to throw you back into that extended state, elevating those rib cage, hypertonicity of those accessory respiratory muscles, and the brain's going to win. We can't sit there and, you know, stretch those muscles and expect to change things unless we actually change things mechanically or neuromuscularly as we speak to the brain.
Yeah. And breathing, you know, breathing is regulated by carbon dioxide, right? If, you know, oxygen's absolutely required for us to survive, you know, the CO2, the waste product, is what actually regulates our desire to take our next breath. And if we stay in that, what we refer to as hyperinflated state, where the ribs are up, the lower rib layers are out. The CO2 levels stay, correct me if I'm wrong here, Jason, they stay too low or too high? Too low. The CO2 levels stay too low. We're constantly trying to inhale, and you may find somebody with a respiratory rate of 16, 18, 20 plus breaths per minute because they're constantly trying to get in more air when the problem is, in fact, they have too much air in. So you teach that person to exhale, and those muscles that they're designed to tense up under high stress or intense activity. You know, in resting breathing, they're going to make up maybe 10% of overall respiratory activity. In intense activity, that increases 30-40% sometimes. You need to elevate the rib cage if you're running a 400 meter sprint. You need the excess. The problem you get into is when, you know, you stay in that state all the time. And those muscles stay tight and don't know how to shut off. So for me, breathing retraining, whether it's balloon, straw, forced exhale with a hold, you know, almost like a Butenko or, I know several other systems, you know, going to timed exhales and all that. Teaching this person to exhale has got to be my first line of treatment for especially thoracic outlet, really any shoulder issue. When those are tight, and we talked about, you know, internal external rotation being a little bit of a isolationist way of looking at the health of a pitcher's arm. If they are locked up in the scalenes, the internal and external are going to be tight, going to stay tight. So it goes back to, you know, being able to utilize the diaphragm.
The again, just looking at somebody's internal external rotation obviously isn't the be all end all and get that internal rotation and we're good. That's more of an objective test that kind of shows us a position that somebody's in. It kind of lets the patient actually see something. And then when we do a treatment that increases that internal rotation for them, that gives them some objective data so they can see that, hey, yes, this is working, it's kind of changing. But as far as the actual treatment plan and everything else, you know, that internal external rotation of the shoulder isn't the treatment. You know, like I said, it's just kind of objective test to help guide us a little bit. Are we on the right path? And it gives that athlete something that they can see that, oh, you know, something had changed. And then, you know, the biggest thing, obviously, is when we're patient-centered is, okay, well, how do you feel? Now go out and throw after this treatment, after we've relaxed everything. Has your shoulder pain gone away? Or in thoracic outlet, how's your hand feel? Do you have that numbness and tingling down into your hand, or has that subsided?
Right. So I love the practical application of anything that I'm learning here. And so you guys talked about, you know, the holding your right nozzle closed, but you also mentioned a couple times the straw or a balloon exercise. So I saw it on one of those articles you sent, but I don't think it explained how. It just said that they did it. Could you talk to me about how I would do a balloon exercise?
Jason, you want to talk?
Again, that's kind of puts, you know, it's a patient-centered thing in terms of where you're at respiratory-wise. Adding a straw, adding a balloon is kind of like adding a dumbbell to your respiratory muscles. It adds the resistance. Without getting to know you, probably the easiest way would actually, instead of having you in that supine position, and instead of adding that balloon or that straw right away, would be to have you sit there seated with your knees up to at least 90 degrees, kind of hunched over like you are. Have you work on inhaling, expanding your posterior medial stem, trying to force the air in that way, exhaling and engaging your abs, okay, tucking in your obliques. After you're capable of doing that, the next step would be adding a straw. A straw is going to be easier to get the air out of, force the air out of than a balloon. There's a lot of people who, you know, can't blow up balloons. Well, that's because they can't exhale. So you would go through that type of progression. So I would start without knowing you, have you go from that seated position, working on just your inhaling and your exhaling. From there, like I said, try and inhale, fill up your posterior mediastinum as you exhale. Engage those obliques. And then once you've done that a few times and you can handle that, then you just go ahead and add the balloon or the straw, then the balloon. Again, all inspiration should come in through the nose. Exhalation and that will come out the mouth.
Yeah. I actually reached back and grabbed the balloon while you were talking. So I was just going to kind of demonstrate. If Jeremy, would you like something like that?
Sure. Sounds great. Sounds great. And then if there's any talking that needs to go on, then Jason, you can kind of narrate what he's doing since he'll have his mouth on a balloon.
Okay. Notice he is kind of rounded over. Okay. A lot of our times were spent in extension. We're extended. The rib cage is up, externally rotated. So what we're doing is we're actually putting the body, bringing the rib cage down. So we're not using the accessory respiratory muscles. His accessory respiratory muscles can't function in this position. So what this is doing is increasing his use of his diaphragm to inhale. And with that inhalation, we're forcing, instead of the chest up, forcing clearance his posterior medial sternum, making his chest expand. And then with his exhalation, we're bringing the ribs down into an internal rotated state and engaging the obliques.
So it was looking...
The two things,
go ahead, Josh.
Two things that I would teach somebody to focus on, just looking at the thoracic mechanics, they should feel a stretch across the back on the inhale, which when he's saying posterior medius down, that's what we're talking about. And then they should feel both sides of their obliques, but primarily on the left. So as they exhale, they should be getting tighter and tighter and tighter.
Yeah, I saw that you progressively got lower, like your head dipped more with each breath and exhale. And so that's what you said, inhibiting those muscles that we want to inhibit and allowing the muscles that we want to work.
Right. It's, you know, just like the corrective exercise specialist, you know, the NASM stuff or what we're taught in school, it's inhibit, then facilitate. We just happen to be doing both the same exercise.
Gotcha. Go ahead, Jason.
Notice that he had his balloon in his left hand. Because the other thing that you could do to help facilitate that would be to, while he's exhaling, to actually reach towards the floor with that right arm. And again, what that does is, one, helps open up that posterior medial sternum on the left or on the right. But with that reaching, it rotates the thoracic spine back to its correct natural position. And it also, reaching right, is going to engage his left obliques, which is going to help pull that left side down for us even more.
All right, so kind of a silly question, but do you get lightheaded when you're doing that? Because, you know, people get lightheaded when they're blowing up the balloon, and then you're, like, leaning forward. You ever had somebody, like, pass out or anything like that?
I've never had anybody pass out, but pretty much all of my patients, the first time, second time, get relatively lightheaded, yes. That I didn't notice any difference at all, but then again, I demonstrate that every day. So
with that, we're changing somebody's breathing mechanics. They're so used to using the accessory respiratory muscles. We're inhibiting those. We're teaching them how to use the primary muscles, the diaphragm. And like Josh had said, you know, when you're hyperventilated, you're looking at taking in 20 breaths. And what we're doing, they're used to getting all that air in, getting the air in. We're not allowing that to happen. We're kind of preventing that from occurring. And we're also teaching them how to get air out. So when they're used to getting all this air in and not getting it out, we're taking that from them and forcing that air out of them. They're going to get lightheaded and dizzy. Absolutely. Because we're completely changing their respiratory mechanics.
All right. So, I mean, again, obviously that's just a few practical steps that I could try on myself without going through the full course. And I'm not one to try doing this on patients without really understanding what and why and the full deal. But it's fun to learn and see and to, because if I don't understand it, then I'm not going to go learn about it. Right. So,
right.
All right. So what else have you guys got about normalizing breathing that we haven't covered yet?
Well, just, you know, outside of sports and everything else, it changes everything. It, you know, can change movement, which can enhance performance for the athletes. But you're looking at your average day-to-day patient or client. It helps improve their lifestyle. Especially, you look at the number of patients that suffer from low back pain, and you look at the numbers there. if we can get those patients to be able to normalize their breathing, their back pain's going to go away. You know, those discomforts or those ailments that they have can really change. And it helps patients from, you know, little kids to somebody in their 80s, 90s, because technically we're all athletes. You know, we go out there and we move, and we're meant to move and to function. And whether you're doing it on a football field, a baseball field, or whatever, all you're doing is creating bad patterns and bad habits. And, you know, the issue is, can you leave that at the field? Just like somebody who's working in a factory, somebody who's sitting at a desk, they're doing it for hours and hours on end. And what they're doing, again, is they're creating those bad patterns and positions. So right here, we're talking about, you know, working with the athletic population, athletes, and what we do for normalizing the breathing for them, because it can help their movement and performance. But it does reach across the continuum of patient care.
Yeah, kind of add to what you were saying about the low back pain and kind of prepping for this discussion. One of the articles I read was about hyperinflation and low back pain. And in their study participants, I want to say 80% of the people that had experienced low back pain also demonstrated hyperinflation, versus 20-30%, I believe, of the asymptomatic individuals were in a hyperinflated state. And, you know, that's, again, that's a stress position. They're constantly trying to work harder to inhale more air. But on a simple mechanical level, where the lower attachments of the posterior part of the diaphragm are on the anterior spinal column at the L1, L2, L3, you've also got the upper fibers of psoas muscle that come in and attach to the same bones. So if the diaphragm is in that open state, you have a shear position on the spine, because basically there's mechanical overlap. So hyperinflation, low back pain are going to work together. You know, and there's research out there as well on hypocapnia, aka hyperinflation, you know, influence on chest pain, digestive issues. You know, there's studies that exist where in emergency departments, they examined all these individuals complaining of chest pain. They came back negative for any kind of cardiac dysfunction, any kind of angina, any issues related to the heart, or in the more traditional view, you know, with fluid on the lungs or anything like that. But when breathing patterns were regulated, these symptoms absolutely went away. And I can personally speak to that junior year of college, I think, was probably my toughest year academically. I was stressed out. And during that same time, I was 20 years old and having chest pain, and had all kinds of cardiac tests done, you know, echocardiogram, Holter monitor, EKGs multiple times, never found any kind of a cause. And, you know, it'd come and go when I was stressed, but it's like, well, they didn't find anything wrong, so I'm not going to worry about it. Since I started learning this kind of stuff, doesn't happen near as often. And that tells me I was stressed out. I was spending a lot of time hunched over a desk. You know, I was hyperinflated. You know, but now, and really just in prep for this podcast, so Jeremy, thank you for asking me to be on here. You know, I've come across actual research articles that, you know, randomized controlled trials and clinical trials that have, you know, kind of given me an answer for why was I hurting so bad 10 years ago. So I appreciate that. But, yeah, there is, you know, moving aside from any PRI definitions or anything like that, there are scientific articles that correlate, you know, hyperinflated state with all of these systemic issues. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and I can, I know I sent, Mike and Jason a link the other day to a box.com folder with, you know, a bunch of articles that I've read, and I'd be glad to share that with y'all as well.
Yeah, if you send that to me, I can put a link to it. Is it something I can link to and people can see?
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you'll just send me that when you get a chance, and I'll put that there in the show notes. So, very cool. All right. Any other thoughts there, Jason?
No.
Well, it's about the time that we would normally end. So, Josh, any other parting thoughts?
I don't think so.
No. Nope.
I appreciate you having me on here.
Yeah, for sure. If you guys will hang on just 1 second, then I'll close it out. All right, so Jason sent me some articles I talked about. I mentioned those, and I have, again, those are in the show notes here, and then I have a link to the PRI. It's probably easier to research to Google Postal Restoration Institute and get it there. Josh and Mike were on episode 125 before, and again, I have a link to that in the show notes. It's also on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Mike was on episode 123, where he was with his strength coach, Dan Boothby, and they're talking about strength training as healthcare, too. So the links to those, again, show notes. Quickly, school health. I mentioned it last week or in the last episodes. They are entering the partnership with Sports Medicine Broadcast. So the first prizes that I'm going to be giving away are going to be only to the email list. So if you're on my email list, I'm going to pick a name or two or three, however many prizes I have, and give them away to those people on those on that email list. So make sure you get on that email list so that I can send you out information. You can be the first to register for the CU sessions, and then also you can be able to win some of those prizes. But more will be coming for just listeners, but this first set will be only for the people on the email list. So the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society are the ones that sponsor this CEU opportunities, and they make this so that those people listening live can earn CEUs. If you are listening live for the CEU opportunity, make sure you fill out the evaluation form, and then it'll give you the link to the or the password to the CEU certificate area. So check that out there. And then for Mike and Josh and Jason, thanks for being available. If you want to check out our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, want to watch live almost every single Wednesday. Speaking of that, there's not one. There won't be any over the summer because it's summer and I'm not coming up to school. But there will be plenty of other content coming out through the podcast and some. I'll be recording at some sessions, some seminars. So I'll make that stuff available as I can. I'm on Twitter, PHS Sports Med. All right. So for Jeremy, Josh, why don't you go ahead and say goodbye? Then Jason, you follow him.
All right, Jeremy, appreciate you having me on here. It was fun to talk. Jason, it was nice to finally meet you, I guess, in some form or fashion. Look forward to doing it again sometime, maybe.
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks for having me on here. This is actually the first podcast I've done. I've done presentations in front of people. You've seen I've published some articles, but this is a new experience for me, and I actually enjoyed it. And you know, it is good to actually get to see Josh other than a text or email, and yourself as well as Mike. So thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. And then, you know, I think this topic actually came from Josh. I think he was the one that said, hey, let's do something about normalizing breathing. So if you have an idea, throw it out there. Let me know, email, tweet, text, whatever. You got all sorts of ways to get a hold of me. Let me know, and then we'll put it together. We'll find some people that can, you know, agree or disagree with you and go from there. So, well, that's going to be a wrap. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.